Hello, this is Hollywood C, and you're listening to Architecture, Coffee, and Ink, a podcast dedicated to introducing concepts, detailing out designs, and tackling the architecture you might not realize the meaning behind. I'm your hostess, and I am here today to start introducing you to the designs that make you wonder why. So I ask you to brew your coffee, grab your sketchbook and pen, and let's begin. Hello, everyone, and welcome to an extra special episode of Architecture, Coffee, and Ink. A doozy of an episode that has been haunting me, and hopefully will begin slowly edging you into the season for some creepy crawly fun. This is the kickoff of my spooky season, a side series I am calling my Eerie Arc. Each week until Halloween, I'm going to be posting an Eerie Arc episode to be both educational and terrifying this holiday season. This is basically the time of year where I get to tap into the side of me that really wanted to be a horror novelist, and I've decided to do that by blending together my more poetic version from last year with our usual case study format, slowly increasing the spooky in poetry until we reach our final episode arc on the 31st. I do want to take a moment and thank everyone again for bearing with me as I've been adjusting to life. I know that I basically have been averaging an episode a month for the last few months since I graduated, but I am starting to get back into the swing of it. I know that seeing is believing, but I do have plans to continue moving the podcast forward. I have been working hard on these next couple of episodes, and I am super excited to announce that the blog will also be getting its own little Architecture of the Week segment, as recommended by one of my besties, and it will absolutely be spooky season themed as well right now. But beyond the next month, it will be a permanent addition to the AC&I wheelhouse. I will highlight and write up a little piece about something in the field that might not have enough information for its own podcast episode. So make sure you go and follow the blog to receive updates on when those articles are released. And if you or your firm or class or project want to be featured, feel free to write into the show. But I know that y'all are really here for the spooky, so quick trigger warning for this episode. This is scary stories and upsetting situations such as people's death, human trafficking, and the paranormal will be discussed. If this bothers you or triggers you in any way, please see my normal episode where it's just architecture. While I won't go into graphic details at any point because this is a design podcast, I want to make sure that everyone has a comfortable and an enjoyable time. I know some listeners are annoyed by any disclaimers, but I do have young ones listening to the show, so I will continue to do warnings as needed. And this episode deserves its disclaimer. This year, I am kicking off spooky skeleton time with a case study of the tunnels, or should I say, a focus on a pair of network tunnels, the Shanghai Tunnels of Portland, and the Tunnels of Salem, with several brief mentions to the Washington, D.C. tunnel. But the primary core of the episode is going to be on the Shanghai and Salem, both of which were reportedly used to smuggle goods, drugs, and worst of all, people in and out of town, never to be seen again. But of these two, speculation remains. How much of the story is a myth, and how much is a very unfortunate reality? As always, make sure to check your sources, check your facts, and more importantly, check me. If there ever was an episode that I produced that dangerously towed the line of urban legends and design, this is absolutely that episode. I had a doozy of a time going over sources and double-checking facts, as some of them don't quite track between articles. Oh, what a tangle web we weave when we first practice to deceive. For some reason, whenever I come across a tangled spot of history with a lot of background context and side quests, my first instinct is to grab red string and quote Sir Walter Scott too much. And this whole episode was an exercise in restraint, as I was downright cackling as I dove into too many bibliographies and Cosmic Sans websites. There were so many points that you could branch off into side stories and characters that might as well have been a part of Asmerion. For some reason, the trickier the narrative to discover, the more likely I am to try and untangle it, as I firmly believe history to be more of a matted web than a linear progression of events. But don't worry, this is a design and architecture podcast. We are in fact going to be focused on that. But before diving into the architecture, we are going to need some background knowledge, particularly on Shanghai. Both sets of tunnels dealt with this idea of smuggling and forcing people into the service of ships. This form of human trafficking is referred to as Shanghai. While the particulars of how this occur vary and will be discussed in detail later on, Shanghaiing, or crimping, that's C-R-I-M-P-I-N-G, was the act of kidnapping people and forcing them to become sailors. Normally, each crimp, that's C-R-I-M-P, would receive roughly $50 a head in what was called, quote, blood money. The reason the name would later colloquially be referred to as Shanghaiing was because many times the final destination was Shanghai, where merchants were drawn in by the spices and wealth. During the time that this behavior peaked, it would have briefly overlapped with the British occupation of Shanghai, as well as during the particularly lucrative opium wars slash epidemic. The stories we are going to focus on today primarily had individuals most likely forced onto ocean-bound liners, but truthfully, we will probably never know all those who were forced into this, where they landed, much less what ship they ended up on. Shanghaiing definitely occurred and was known to take place throughout multiple port towns up and down all coastal regions. The idea of forcing people to join your crew or die was not new, but the whole specific circumstances and the way that it was conducted was extremely distinct. I want to make sure and point out that while there is currently debate on the existence of the tunnel and how they were used, the fact of human trafficking and the forcible enlistment of people into services is absolutely not in dispute. We know this horrible practice occurred, and human trafficking continues to be a battle that many fight against today. But what is being disputed in this episode is the level of involvement that occurred within the tunnels themselves and to what extent they existed. And that's really the major point of contention. Going back to the rise of Shanghaiing during this time period, what several sources attribute to being the main reason that there was a staffing shortage is due in no small part to the gold rush of 1849. What would happen is that ships would come into port, and due to the allure of gold and striking it rich, the main crew would abandon the ship, either never coming back onto the ships after shore leave, or, in some cases, they alleged that the sailors would just jump overboard as soon as the ship came in close enough to shore in order to seek their fortunes. Eventually, reportedly, it got so bad crews were not allowed to exit the boats at all until the final destination. That's excluding all of those who in the past would have turned to the sea for work. They were now choosing to travel inland instead. Without a crew, ships were left stranded, so captains and companies started to turn to other means to acquire able-bodied men. In fact, another word thrown about during this time period would have been to, quote, press gang someone, which is very specifically referring to the idea of being forced to join the Navy or Army. The thing is, under both of these, that these men would sign legally binding documentation under gunpoint or while drugged and intoxicated. The most commonly referenced way I saw mentioned was by drugging their whiskey or even just a club to the back of the head. Clubbing the back of the head is not ideal, as it takes a lot of practice to avoid death or head trauma. And if the person being sold is unable to work, then the kidnapper doesn't get paid. All this to say that if someone worked on a ship and then attempted to leave, their captors were able to provide what basically amounted to ownership papers in some cases, meaning that they were able to use whatever local law enforcement was around each port to forcibly return any runaway sailors to the ship or declare them fugitive. The choice for many of these men became either prison, ships, or death. And I read many stories about those who woke up too far from the shore to even think to swim to land. One article included an interview with a lady whose uncles, or perhaps great uncles, swore that this happened to them and were fortunate enough to wake before the ship got too far from land, and they were able to jump overboard in time to make it back and hide out. And at this time, going to sea was not the way we think of it now. They had very limited rations, and if they didn't perform up to standard, they could be keen-hauled, barred and feathered, flogged, or hanged from the yardarm, to name a few more common punishments. The dangers of the sea alone would oftentimes cause an incredibly difficult life, lowering the average life expectancy quite a bit during an already low time. This practice eventually began to wane, and after 50 years of the legislation, became illegal with precautions set in place to stop this practice. The official end of it in the United States was with the 1915 Seamen's Act. When I was researching and trying to read copies of a lot of the original sources for this episode, I got really angry. There was a lot of bigotry running rampant throughout the laws and the reports from this time. I think it goes without saying that I'm extremely against this practice, but just in case I need to disclaimer it. I am absolutely against all forms of human trafficking and will actually be including a few links to a few good organizations that are currently fighting to end it on the blog. So if you are able to support them or get involved, please do. I am not a paid sponsor of, well, anyone, just an advocate for change who firmly believes in celebrating and respecting all of the cultures and people we discuss. But going back to the tunnels, the thing is that for historians, they seem to both exist and not simultaneously. And this paradox is due in no small part to the various social issues, as well as the many conflicting purported uses of the tunnel. Another word that will be bandied about as a theme is the Prohibition, which is a time period wherein alcohol was illegal, and we as a country got downright crafty with where we hid our booze. I can and will do an entire episode on this article later, but while the Prohibition only started in the 1920s, the need and desire for squirreling away various things and hidden treasures will pop up again and again throughout the rest of the episode. So just kind of hold this idea in your mind for a few minutes and decide for yourself whether they were created to hide vices or whether the tunnels had a much more nefarious purpose from the very start. We are going to start our tales of tunnels not with the famous Shanghai, but instead with the Salem Tunnels. While the Salem Tunnels are located in Salem, Massachusetts, when researching both locations, there was a lot of misinformation and information that I couldn't back up to other sources. There was also some crossover, such as where exactly we are focusing our story today. So we are going to be focusing today on Salem, Massachusetts. I noticed some sources accidentally mixing up some facts for Salem, Oregon in them, which is completely understandable as both towns, despite being across the country from each other, have tunnels and a potential history of Shanghai. So if you are looking through the source list later this week, I kept a few of the good articles for Salem, Oregon, to help you in case you want to continue to study it yourself later on. There are supposed to be tunnels there as well, but I'm not going to mention them beyond this point. Now back to our Salem tunnels. They are lesser known as the Salem witch trials overshadow them in no small way. Witch hunts and legislation against witchcraft has claimed countless victims, and there are countries with legislation still actively prohibiting witchcraft to this day. While the events of the mass hysteria and political campaign-driven Salem witch trials happened before our tale begins, the effects of it continued on, and it sets up the backdrop for the tunnels to truly take off. Prior to the trials, Salem was a Puritan town, driven by religion and strict morals. However, the trials themselves seemed to seep in and stain the ground, and where there once was an emphasis on religious piety, a hole emerged. And, like a hole in the sand too close to the dark turning tide, it was swiftly filled with the very vices they once abstained from. The thing about human vices, which in this case include drugs, alcohol, prostitution, and gambling, is that they present as an opportunity. For a politician, it can be the very start of a beautification campaign and a front for a more sinister purpose. And for someone looking to make someone disappear, well, society tends not to look too hard for those that they have already rejected. The start of the Salem Tunnels actually kicks off in Washington, D.C., and with a man named Charles Bulfinch. Charles Bulfinch lived from 1763 to 1844, and he was considered to be among the first American-born architects, with the country itself being born in 1776. He graduated from Harvard and studied an itinerary of architecture crafted by Thomas Jefferson, emphasizing European studies, quote, but as life as an architect in that time was a bit rougher than the life of the starchitects and influencers you design students might be focusing on now. Over the course of his life, he would actually end up in one of the prisons he himself designed due to debt. Despite his long list of attributed buildings and work, he went at times unpaid. His work included an array of private residences, churches, and public buildings, most famous of which include the Massachusetts State House. He was also credited as the founder of the Federalist style, and his list of works often included asterisks and notes denoting buildings that he is believed to have been involved with, but remains unconfirmed. Now, whether that is due to him being suspected of having a direct hand or just a strong influence remains to be seen. And if you are a fan of Greek mythology, you might have recognized his last name, as his son was the author of the Bullfinch Mythology, which is one of the most comprehensive collections of Greek myths in English that was published after his son's death. Nevertheless, a few years after Charles stayed in debtor's prison, and he was in prison in July 1811, he met James Monroe, who was in town on a week-long stay, and both of them immediately clicked and reportedly spent the rest of Monroe's visit together. This trip would eventually kick off Charles' career into Washington, D.C., where he was appointed by the then President Monroe as the third architect of the Capitol. This was the title of a position, which was then later abolished by Andrew Jackson while Charles was in office in 1829. Though it did not stop Charles from eventually retiring to Boston, so if you haven't heard of this position, that's why. Apparently, it only paid a yearly sum of $2,500, which in today's market would be around $60,000 a year for both American dollars and euros at the time of me researching this. Euros would be slightly above and American slightly below. But while he was the third architect, he designed the U.S. Capitol grounds, West Terraces, U.S. Capitol building, and more, but most importantly for us, he reportedly was involved in the Washington, D.C. tunnels. With the tunnel architect involved, the Capitol Hill tunnels were originally designed with practicality in mind. As someone who has previously lived around DC, I can attest that the area can get quite hot, and having alternative ways to move between buildings without having to venture to the surface could only be a plus. The tunnels themselves were added onto over the years, and some are currently open to the public between the buildings today. Among the buildings reported to have tunnels are the Capitol, Adams, and Jefferson Building. My favorite story I read about the DC tunnels was how at one point they formed a, quote, joint committee on ventilation to deal with the heat within one of the buildings, and the solution was to add giant propellers and a secondary pair of tunnels you could fill with ice to get a draft in. And instead, every time they added good old-fashioned fertilizer to the garden, all they got was an overwhelming smell of manure. A hot, sun-baked pile of manure. Basically, each time an addition was added to the hill, more and more tunnels were added to connect everything together. It's funny, in this episode, the tunnels have almost attained a breathing, growing consciousness of their own, slowly adding on itself. There really is a nice image, a sectional I found, on the Washington, D.C. Tunnels website of a Senate wing. The site has a scrolling story where you can scroll through the entire history and see visuals of the growing network. I highly recommend it, and I know that they were legit when I found the newer story pretty much on the first page, as it is a story that I had actually previously learned, and normally you don't see it too often. So I would definitely check them out. But back to why we even remotely care. While we know for sure that Charles Bullfinch designed the tunnels, we also know that he was involved with the Derby Mansion, a 6-bank building, the Asylum, an old town hall in Salem, Massachusetts. And at some point in his career, he developed, or rather perfected, a design where the chimneys were used to provide access to secret tunnels through the arches in the basement. Now, here's where the plot starts to slowly unravel, depending upon the source you're referencing. So we need a brief timeline of important Salem dates. Settlers first arrived in 1626, and the town was incorporated in 1629. In 1636, the town had its first muster on an area of land that we will be revisiting. A muster is basically a formal gathering of troops, so this really was the first time the town assembled their militia. In 1668, we have the extremely famous House of the Seven Gables built, which Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote of in his book of the same name. And then in 1692, we have the start of the Salem witch trials. In 1757, Samuel McIntyre was born, a Salem-born American architect and craftsman that will be mentioned a couple times as we move forward. In 1830, the Rhode Island American wrote that the town of Salem, Massachusetts was, quote, forever stained with blood, blood, blood. And it seemed like this blood-tainted ground at one point infected all it touched. The Salem of today is a wonderful town full of friendly people. Strongly driven by tourism, the picturesque backdrop of the town makes it hard to believe that tragedy once soaked the land. The story picks back up with the commission of the Derby Mansion by Captain Richard Derby, for his son, Elias Caskus Derby Sr., on his marriage to Elizabeth Crown and Shield in 1762. Derby Sr. became a merchant and was at one point the 10th richest American to ever live, but he has since been bumped off that list, but is still in the top 75 richest humans with a wealth that today would be around $31.4 billion. That's a billion with a B. According to which source you reference, the Derby Mansion, or quote, Little Brick Home, was either designed by Charles Bolfin or prepared by Charles and then finished by Samuel McIntyre, with four jutting chimneys that stuck out above it. Senior quickly exceeded the wealth of his father, the captain. In addition to being a merchant, Derby Senior was reportedly involved with privateers, which is legal pirates. Piracy was illegal, and anyone caught practicing would be charged. Pirateers was completely legal, as they had submitted the correct documentation, which apparently means that any horrid acts are completely okay, because at least they pay taxes. There are multiple famous ships associated with him from the American Revolution and this time period in general, but unfortunately I don't have time to go through all those ships as well. But just assume that if he had the opportunity to get involved, he absolutely did. And I wouldn't be willing to testify about how legal any of it was. In addition, he built the Derby Wharf in 1762 as well, which is Salem's longest wharf, extending the length of a half a mile, or 0.805 kilometers. Derby Wharf has become one of the busiest areas in Salem, and in no small way contributed to the success of Senior as one of the first millionaires in the country. Derby Senior basically created an empire and spoiled his children, so much so that Elias Haskus Derby Jr., who inherited the wealth of his father upon Senior's death in 1799, would soon spend beyond his means. He would also inherit an extremely expensive house for the time period. It needed a lot of money for upkeep and would overall be a rather large drain on finances. He would become broke enough that he needed to find another form of employment to maintain the lifestyle that he was accustomed to. Now, I say broke. I don't ever believe he ever fell even into upper middle class levels, but I genuinely couldn't figure it out. But he had inherited a record-breaking amount of wealth and managed to go through it in a matter of years. But apparently, that's broke and desperate enough to consider some less than legal means. I mentioned how after the Derby Wharf was built in 1762, it quickly became one of the busiest locations in Salem. As a port, it was known to be filled in its heyday with globally acquired goods. Derby Sr. used it for his various businesses. Junior, upon inheriting the wealth of his father, developed a taste for privateering and exotic trinkets. Junior was a member of a maritime society. The society is still in existence today with a very different goal than when Junior was a member. I want to be completely clear, they may have the same name, but the society that Junior was in is pretty much a completely different thing. Junior realized that as the members of the group then were among the most powerful and richest of Salem, if he could acquire exotic things and trinkets, many members would purchase them, and it would be a great way to remass the squandered wealth. The issue quickly became, how did he get the artifacts and other substances of ill repute somewhere safe and hidden until buyers could be arranged? Well, he quickly realized, what better way to do that than to utilize and create a tunnel system scattered throughout town? The thing is, I read several sources that seemed to indicate that there was tunnels already in existence that he expanded upon. One seemed to indicate that his father had one. Other sources claimed that he was starting from scratch, so I think I would need to literally visit the town and physically search through some of the primary sources that aren't online for me to make any sort of comment either way. But what I am confident about is how terrifyingly brilliant his plan was to sneak them in under everyone's nose. It didn't take long for Junior to realize that there was an ideal location and opportunity to construct his network. Remember how I mentioned that the militia had a location where they first gathered for their muster all those years ago? Well, that area, due in no small part to the first muster, came to be called the Salem Common. Now, prior to this point, the commons were essentially swamp and wasteland, with homes dotting around. So, a Junior, in a show of hometown patriotism, proposed a beautification project for what is today called the Salem Common Historic District. In his proposal, which kicked off in 1801, it was promoted as a beautification project that would be a great way for the community to generate tourism, provide community enrichment, and bring both money and notable names back into the community. Now, of course, remember that Junior is not at the top of his wealth, which is why he needs the tunnel. So, he ended up getting several notable people to finance the commons, raising altogether $2,500, which is the exact same number we had earlier, so we know that this would be roughly 60K for the project. He would end up leveling hills, implementing poplar trees, which would be later replaced with elms. Alongside this, part of the project included the creating of brick homes for several of the donors, several of which are still standing today. It was at this point that he was able to increase the number of bricks ordered to build the home to instead build his tunnels with, as most individuals can't tell how many bricks are needed to build a home by just looking at a pile. Supposedly, he used them to build tunnels connecting to various parts of town, allowing for the sailors and privateers to bring in the goods without ever stepping foot on land. Now, for what those goods are depends upon what source you read. The most terrifyingly brilliant part of this is he was able to shift dirt as needed from job site to job site in full view of everyone. After this gets put into place, with many homes having brick chimneys and fireplaces serving as entrances into the secret underground, it seems that he didn't stop there. Multiple tunnels are reported to have been made across town, and apparently rumors are that some of the tunnels were to houses of ill repute, such as brothels. Now, today, multiple tunnels have been filled in due to safety reasons or collapsed. I have seen in a few documentaries where they show several bricked up entrances that you can pretty clearly see the two different bricks. But now's when we start to move into the ghost story. Derby Street, and what is now Derby Street Historic District, had become the center of prostitution, alcohol, and gambling. And as such, brothels and gambling dens started to appear, including one that would later become in a pigsty tavern that is today named Mercy Tavern. When it was a brothel, it started to get an absolutely horrible reputation. Reported some missing sailors and patrons who were seen entering but never leaving started to crop up with alarming regularity. Men who were coming in to relax and indulge were never heard again until one day their screams started emerging from beneath the street. It is said that ghost pirates still walk from the shores and follow the same routes they once took to the same taverns and bars, regardless of whether or not they're still standing. Trapped spirits are said to be stuck in cycles of either merriment or torture, depending upon where you are in town. But I promised y'all a murder, and a murder I shall deliver. At 128 Essex Street, just across from what is now Hawthorne Road from the Commons, was a house originally built in 1804. It is a masterpiece built by none other than Samuel McIntyre, and is currently called the Gardner Pingree House. It was built for John Gardner, who is none other than Derby Senior's nephew, meaning that he is the cousin of Junior, one that was apparently rather close to him. Gardner, like his family, also turned to the sea to create his fortune as a merchant. The house was built in a Federalist style and has a rather beautiful set of chimneys. It was sold several times between Juniors and Seniors until the War of 1812 caused the family to sell it in 1814 to Captain Joseph White. White was an absolutely horrible human being. who was actively involved in anything that made money, including the slave trade. As you might have guessed from the date, he would have been operating out of the Derby Wharf, most likely at some point, and his home was built suspiciously close in both proximity and date of construction to the tunnel, in case nobody has picked up on my heavy hints thus far. Fast forward in time to 1830, and he had retired at 82 to his house on Essex Street with his niece, Mary Beckford. Mary was 40 to 45, and doted on her uncle. They also had two servants, Benjamin, and the housekeeper, Linda Kimball. On April 6, 1830, it was a day like normal. White went through the normal day-to-day rituals that one acquires after 82 years of life, and finally retired for the evening, issuing his nightly orders to the help and saying goodnight to his niece. That was the last evening anyone saw White alive. In the morning, Benjamin would start his morning tours and would notice an open window on the back of the property. Knowing that White kept a small fortune of gold doubloons in his room, he went immediately to rouse White to alert him to the situation. Instead, he saw the body of White laid out in his bed, body not quite cold to the touch. When he was examined by the doctor, it was discovered that while the blow to his head most likely killed him, the 13 stab wounds that littered across his body made sure he stayed dead. The murderer even moved him around, making sure to stab him in multiple places. The head wound hadn't broken the skin, so it seemed like the sources I read were inferring that perhaps the murderer was going to excess to make sure White was dead. They continued to stab him until his blood saturated the sheet, with the worst of the wounds being those by his heart. Upon discovering the body, Benjamin told Linda what had happened, then fetched Stephen White, his nephew, a Massachusetts legislator, who in turn sent for Dr. Samuel Johnson and William Ward, who was Captain White's clerk. By the window were two muddy footprints that they attempted to preserve by placing an old milk pan over them upside down. Of his wounds, the doctor said, quote, 5 stabs in the region of the heart, 3 in front of the left calf, and 5 others still further back, as though the arm had been lifted up and the instrument struck underneath. And for a while, no one knew what happened. People began to treat each other with suspicion. This act showed a disregard for life, and the longer no one was found, the longer they began to believe that everyone and anyone could be the guilty party. A committee of vigilance was formed while Salem panicked, and despite the fact that he offered money to the cause, Stephen White, along with the husband of Mary Beckford's daughter, newlywed Joseph Knapp Jr., was suspected. While White had taken over the business entirely, Knapp was originally one of the captains for the company, and then a letter came. Knapp Sr. received a letter demanding payment for the signer's silence. Knapp Sr., who thus far has had nothing to do with anything, was rightly confused, and after consulting his children, decided to give the missive to the committee upon the advice of Jr. It wasn't hard for the committee to figure out who wrote the letter, given that he was kind enough to sign the bottom with his real first name and fake last. Upon which they discovered the horrible truth. The would-be blackmailer was a man named Charles Palmer, though he gave his well-known alias of Grant Jr., or at least well enough known that they were able to pick out who he was incredibly quickly. He admitted that 2 brothers named George and Richard Crowninshield were bragging about being paid to murder Captain White so that Joseph Knapp Jr. would inherit part of the fortune through his wife, the grandniece and daughter of Mary. Upon researching, they discovered that Mary's daughter was actually his favorite, and Captain White forbid the marriage to Joseph Knapp Jr., as Knapp had been an even worse person than White, and was prone to bragging about still owning slaves after it was declared illegal, and generally womanizing, gambling, drinking, the whole 9 yards. He was fired from the company when they married, but it wasn't quite public yet that White had also disowned her and thus Knapp Jr., meaning that he is planning on writing them both out of the will. But should Captain White die without a will, the estate would be divided up, including a large sum given to Mary Beckford, Joseph Knapp Jr.'s mother-in-law, giving him direct access to part of the money. Now Junior thought that the will had not been updated yet, and that it was kept in the chest with the gold. So he and his brother, John Francis, most commonly called Frank, paid both Crown and Shields to murder Captain White for $1,000. The plan was for Knapp Jr. to visit and steal what he thought was the correct will in the chest and open the window for the brothers. No will equals easy money. Richard Crown and Shield crafted the club that would deliver the killing blow, and also the dirt. As you may have guessed, there was already another will. Stephen, he was actually the executor, and no money was given to him, but he did inherit the business he was already running, and the correct will had already been updated and given to lawyers to hold. Captain White had actually divided up the money amongst all his nieces and nephews, meaning that the mother-in-law did receive money, as well as others. Meaning that even with Captain White's death, Knapp Jr. never saw a penny, but now because he was the one who committed the crime. Palmer had heard the Crown and Shields talk about it, and as someone who had been in and out of prison, decided it was a great opportunity to make a quick buck. Both sets of brothers were sent to Salem Gaol. But the story doesn't stop there. Knapp Jr. confessed after being visited by a minister multiple times, but admitted that he and Frank were too afraid, which is why the other brothers were contacted. Apparently, no one knew who was considered the primary guilty party, as Frank was the one who hired the other brothers technically, and the minister made it seem like everyone was confessing something. What really happened is they got Joseph Jr. to write and sign a confession. Unfortunately, this circle of telephone continued. As the primary person who committed the crime, Richard had to be convicted first under Massachusetts state law. Without his conviction, no one else could be tried, or at least that's what he read in a newspaper when he read that Joseph had folded, and he then confirmed with Frank's lawyer, Dexter. And so, in an effort to spare his brother and Frank, he hung himself in his cell, as the lawyer had confirmed that were he to die, nothing could be done so long as another principal or primary suspect couldn't be chosen. One of the more famous quotes about the case said that there is no refuge from confession but suicide, and suicide is confession. In one of the most famous trials, Daniel Webster gave a speech that inspired many and can still be viewed today in its entirety. Frank was tried and convicted as the new primary, and both him and Joseph Jr. hang. George Crown and Shield was acquitted as he had an alibi. He had been in bed with two ladies, both of whom provided testimony that he was with them all night. George lived until 1888. And claimed until his death that it was never his brother that murdered Captain White, but he was instead killed at the hand of his nephew Stephen. This murder captured everyone's attention, so much so that it was the inspiration of The Tattletale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe, and was included throughout Nathaniel Hawthorne's works. If you look carefully, we can see references in several of his work. But what does this have to do with the tunnels, other than just the people being related in various ways? One of the primary reasons that people claim today proves that none of the brothers were involved was that all of them would have had knowledge of the tunnel. They were all involved in the sea trade in some way, in human trafficking in several cases. I think one was a bartender, and one was married into the family. So they would have had knowledge of the secret tunnels. So if they were involved, why didn't they use them? And one of the answers given was that defense only works if the tunnels ever actually existed. A rumor has popped up over the years that Clue, or Cluedo, the board game, was designed based on this murder and this house. That all the rooms can be traced to the layout of the house at Essex Street, and the secret tunnels are the ones that we have been discussing all episode. The Parker Brothers, the game company, was originally from Salem in the 1880s when George S. Parker created the business. Once his brothers joined him, it became the Parker Brothers. The thing is, Clue, or Cluedo, is referenced by multiple sources I found as having been started by Anthony E. Pratt and his wife, Elva Ava, in the 1940s in England. As a part of his gig as an entertainer, he would reenact and play murder mystery scenes for his crowd, calling it murder, until he and his wife developed it during the air raids in England, turning it into a game, patented in 1944, and sold to Waddington's, an English game company, through Norman Watson. It was patented again in 1947 and released in 1949 to the world. Eventually, the Parker brothers joined forces with the English company to market to the Americans. When it was launched by the Parker brothers, it was stamped with Waddington's, Leeds, England. But the Parker brothers took it in a new direction, associating it with Sherlock Holmes and promoting it as, quote, the great detective game. So, if there is any truth to this rumor, it would not surprise me to discover that while they were creating specialty versions, the company either adapted or promoted the association to the murder. Of course, Anthony Pratt was himself a crime aficionado, oftentimes studying and researching real crimes. But I leave that for you to decide. After all, what is history but the tangled web we weave for our own purposes? So that is actually where I'm going to stop, and keep an eye out for part two coming out later this week, where I discuss the Shanghai tunnels, as this episode is already so much longer than our usual episodes of Me Alone. But since it's part of our Halloween art, I'm not going to make you wait any longer than a few days to finish this episode out. But thank you once again for joining me this week. And just as an aside, on the blog post, along with the complete list of our sources as usual, I will have several images from one of my best friends who actually visited Salem and are letting me post some of the pictures they took this past few weeks. One is Gage Emanuel, who was in the episode, An Interview with a Papermaker, and him and Emily sent me several pictures, including one of Derby Square. They're both great photographers, so please check those out. I actually have a couple of notes that I'm not including in the episode underneath each of the photos, and the blog is the only place to get that information. We are also celebrating one very busy first year of Architecture Coffee and Ink. It may have been with several breaks and multiple moves, but we have officially been a podcast for 1 year. In honor of our first year, I am finally doing the highly requested Leap Castle next week. I've already started writing and recording parts of it, so it is absolutely going to be released on the 25th. Thank you once again for joining us this week, and a particular happy birthday to three of my favorite people. I am excited as this time of year kicks off. I absolutely love this time of year. And now that I'm officially in Middle Colonies, I get to experience it again in a way I haven't since I was a little girl. But if you're interested in speaking on the show, whether it's yourself, your firm, or just a topic you're particularly passionate about, don't hesitate to reach out, either the website or email address, all of which is Architecture, Coffee, and Ink. There are several other ways to get in touch with me, all of which are located on the blog. The blog post for this episode will come out later this week before the part two releases on Friday. Please rate, review, and subscribe if you want to see more content. It seriously helps. I'm excited to meet with all my designers, dreamers, and DIY enthusiasts next time. But in the meantime, may your coffee mugs be full and your inkwells never run dry.